Yes, I'm Louis Thompson with Cavilco Incorporated in Cassant. I feel that we have to defend ourselves again at this, based on the past testimony. There's so many policies that have arisen over what the private landowner can and can't do. I've been involved, like I said, last night, since 1973 as an officer of the corporation. And we are treated the same as the national forest land. We have to file for proper permits through the regulating agencies, including the Fish and Game. This is one of the things that I mentioned in my testimony last night, that it seems like we were given the right by an act of Congress. However, we have to continually battle for our rights that we were supposedly have given under the terms of the act. To speak against the testimony that was previously stated here, that we are under the jurisdiction of the agencies. We have to abide by 100-acre clear cut. We're under the Forest Practice Act and forest management practice. We're monitored by the Fish and Wildlife. We're monitored by the Department of Natural Resources under a permitting process. In fact, there's a permitting process going on right to date under the EPA. EPA is proposing a permitting process. So there's nothing I feel that's any different than under the national public lands, under the national forest, that their permitting process and regulations are covered, or do cover our situation as well. We didn't receive a title to our land until December of 1979. We developed the land use plan in 1980. It's that I would hold it up against anything that any management plan or land use plan that is devised by a federal or state agency. It covers all the areas of concern that the non-native or the general public areas would be concerned with. The protection of eagle nesting sites. I realized that there was a lot of inequities in the act. There was no consideration made for monetary considerations for areas that are encumbered by eagle nesting sites that comprise approximately 5 acres or a 320-foot radius around an eagle nesting tree. That is basically an isolated area that's withdrawn. In our situation, we're covered with 33 eagle nests in our land selection of 23,040 acres, which is comprised probably about 30 miles of shoreline. On the subsistence use, I'm very actively involved annually on our subsistence program that's beneficial to both native and non-native alike, because I think if anybody took the time to do any research, they would find that the subsistence areas are basically outside of the native-owned lands. We have to use public lands and go through the permitting process for subsistence use as well. And we fish hand in hand with both native and non-native that's within our region or even outside of our region that comes in. So I think that, you know, there's really no difference between the public lands and the private owned lands. And I think to address another fact that there's patent mining claims in the area that have been logged, and they have to go through the similar process. They have to go for permits to the Corps of Engineers or Natural Resources, and it's reviewed by all agencies as well. So there is other land areas that are involved in timber harvesting. And I think that there's another consideration made as far as they had a problem with the 100-acre clear cut, and they'd done a study to see how the effect was on the wildlife habitat in areas that were larger than 100 acres, and they find that it's far superior to harvest areas that are larger than 100-acre clear cut. One of the things that I might point out is that based on earlier studies or inventories of timber on native land holdings, that they felt that they could, they under the sustained yield program, they would be allowed to harvest between 5 and 6 million annual, an annual cut, board foot cut annually. Under the current market conditions and logging costs and moving costs, that wouldn't sustain anybody's lifestyle. So I think that the definition of a sustained yield harvest has been redefined to mean whatever it takes from a monetary standpoint to sustain the life or the viability of a native corporation. And I hope that I'll get an opportunity to further present more testimony as time goes by.
Could I, this might be a useful time to pursue this since both Mr. Smith and you are here, and I, certainly not up to me to sort this question out, but I'm interested in the issue that was raised. Well, and Mr. Smith, argument is that this is in part owing to the choice of for-profit corporations as a vehicle. But what Mr. Smith and you are really, it seems to me, arguing about is the legitimacy of the sustained yield plan that the private native corporations are pursuing. There's two things that arise. And after you've commented on them, perhaps Mr. Smith would. You say that sustained yield has been redefined to mean a program of cropping timber that will enable the corporation to remain viable. Well, if it's been redefined, it's been redefined from something else. It used to be something else, I suppose, then, presumably that was a program that enabled the forest to regenerate on a basis that enabled it to be logged again at a regular point in the growth cycle. Do you want to comment on that, Mr. Thompson?
I might point out that the redefinition is probably of my own defining. The process of a self-sustain or a annual sustained yield would be to so that your crops be rotated under a, say, a 100-year cycle. That's based on what the Forest Service plans call for, in at least in southeastern Alaska. However, I I would disagree with that based on market conditions. I would say that it's more like a 120 to 150 year cycle. There's other factors that I think that the Forest Service is only human. They're such a large entity. They're not involved on as close to the land as they really feel they are, and I think that when they talk of an 80 to 100 year cycle, I think they're several years off on it. And I know they're off on a lot of other things too, but that I have a bad feeling with them because of their contesting our eligibility.
Well, they lost that, you say.
They lost that.
So that's over.
That's over and done with, but the feeling probably carries on. I hope not, but we have a fairly good working relationship with the Forest Service, I might point out. But the sustained yield harvest, in our circumstance, with based on 23,000 acres, we couldn't justify contracting with a logger to log 6 million or 5 million or 4 million feet, and under market standards today, that's diminished because the grade of the wood has to be a little higher than what was utilized in the past. And I think that the effect's being felt by all, as well as the Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service, and the private landowners.
The other point that I'd like you to comment on, if you would, and Mr. Smith as well, is this: Mr. Smith really was saying that that the logging programs established in the Native corporations, and he said the logging programs established in the publicly owned lands, the one more quickly than the other, but both in time, would reduce significantly the biological productivity of the land. In other words, as I understood him, he really wasn't zeroing in on the Native corporations, because he said in publicly owned land, under U.S. Forest Service regulation, he sees the same outcome. I hope I'm doing justice to what he said. Any comment on that? That is, if he's right. Yeah, I don't know whether he's right or not, but if he's right, whether it's Native corporation land or publicly owned land, there really is going to be less game available for subsistence users in, I think he said, 30 years. Now, your argument is, I suppose, that even if he's right, the logging programs that your corporation is engaged in, it can't be altered, because then the corporation wouldn't be able to make a profit.
Basically, that's what it would be, because there is no other financial resources available other than the liquidation of assets for the profit making corporations. However, I think we'll find that they'll see a large decline in harvesting of the timber, even on the private owned land, in the next few years because of the market conditions. I think they'll find other means of survival.
The companies. Well, I thought you said the market's going to come to the rescue of the game.
Well, basically, that's what I'm saying. The market will come to the rescue of the game. And I think, you know, our concerns are preservation of the game as well. We have areas that that we won't be looking at total clear cut 23,000 acres of land. By nature of our selection, we've selected the areas that are non-merchantable timber that will never be harvested, that will bear shelter for game, as well as leaving shoreline fringes that for aesthetic value or for animal life that are basically the fur bearers that are shoreline. So I think, you know, we maintain buffers around the fish streams, which are where fur bearing animals gather. So I don't think that we'll really see a large effect, at least not within our land holdings. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Jones, and then we'll hear from Mr. Smith.
Willard Jones, a couple of things that I think may be worth mentioning. One, the fact that Sea Alaska just got an award for doing some outstanding logging practices in road building. A while back, they did get a slap in the hands for not obeying somebody. So that kind of a learning process goes on there. It was kind of ironic that appears to be developing a little dichotomy between the original wildlife and fish protectionist and those now that are trying to protect fish and game. But trying to recall some of the information that we heard, that the at least the deer like the type of growth that comes up after clear cutting. I really have problems with clear cutting, but it apparently is a good way of doing it. The problem with deer, there's too many people. And this was mentioned.
That's the problem with fish, too.
Right, too many people. So, but I know in Kasana, when we were small, that there used to be an awful lot of deer. Wolf has been protected. You maintain that there's a balance between the wolves and the deer, but once this balance is upset, then it's pretty easy to be out of balance again for a long time. So I think that if we want deer, you're allowed to get one, or kill off a bunch of wolves, or eliminate a lot of people. Thank you.
Those are the alternatives.
That's the alternative.
Actually, I find that I probably agree with both of the previous individuals more than they might suspect. I think you indicated at one point that Mr. Thomas and I had some argument over sustained yield, what that meant or how it was going about, and I don't really see that there's any argument there, and I can certainly understand how some of the smaller village corporations with relatively limited holdings can't be expected to manage their forests on an even flow sustained yield basis. There are a lot of different ways you can undertake a sustained yield. On a 100 to 120 year rotation, you can either cut all of your timber in 10 years and then wait 90 years and go back and do it again, or you could cut at the other end of the extreme 1% per year. And market economics and capability of the land and a lot of other things will dictate which of those approaches or somewhere in between that you fall. And that's not really the point that I was getting at in terms of the effects of how the timber is being managed. The other problem of the decline in biological productivity, again, will occur regardless of how the logging is undertaken, and whether you do it all at once or over a period of time. Whenever you convert the existing old growth forest, particularly the higher volume stands, which are important to deer, for example, during winter months, into clear cuts, which are unavailable if you have snow during a snowy winter, or once you get the regeneration and it closes in and the understory plants are completely shaded out, the productivity of those lands are going to be reduced. And if out of a land base of 23,000 acres, I think is what you indicated that corporation had, if they logged 50%, then the productivity of that 50% would be reduced, or 10% would be reduced. And whether that means that there would actually be a 10% or a 50% reduction in the deer, we aren't to that point yet, but there would be some reduction in the capability of the land to produce deer for whatever users. One other point I wanted to make is that a problem of testifying in this sort of a structured meeting with I presumed a fairly limited amount of time. I came in and painted with a fairly broad brush, and I suspect that there are village corporations which are managing their land somewhat differently than the general impression that one gets, particularly when looking at some of the activities that have been undertaken in the past. I would agree that Sea Alaska has gotten better in their logging practices in recent years, but they still and this is the one place I think where Mr. Thomas and I would disagree. If there is in fact a 100 acre limit on native clear cuts, it's certainly not being enforced on this island anyway, nor in the vicinity of Big Salt Lagoon or any number of other places throughout Southeast where you can go and just drive up the road to the White River, and you can see that virtually the entire Ward Creek drainage was logged off in a very short period of time. There's about 1,200 to 1,500 acres in that single clear cut. The White River, the entire north side of the drainage has been basically slicked off within the last year. A large cut is being initiated in Whipple Creek right now. So some of the corporations in some areas are cutting these extensive areas. There are restrictions, as was pointed out, particularly with respect to fish streams and log dump locations, and various state and federal agencies do have some regulatory effect over or control over the influences of the private timber operators, but the limit of the 100-acre clear cut is certainly not being widely enforced. And then as for the information that larger clear cuts are better for deer, I can simply say that in numerous years of experience in working in British Columbia's coastal forest and Alaska's coastal forest, in attending conferences and reading the literature and dealing with biologists who have studied deer and logging and forest succession throughout the area, the indication that I have, the feeling that I have, is that larger clear cuts are not better for deer. So, any other questions?
What about your point that this same tendency is observable in those operations under U.S. Forest Service jurisdiction? You said that the very same thing is happening there.
Right. Well, under the current Tongass Land Management Plan, the areas on the Tongass National Forest, over the course of the rotation, if the Tongass Land Management Plan were not revised, and it's scheduled for revision at the end of every 10-year period, so some changes may occur. But under the present plan, if that were carried out through to the end of the rotation, with the exception of those areas which are currently protected as wilderness areas, Admiralty Island and several other wilderness areas scattered around through southeast, all but I believe it's 11 to 13% of the operable commercial timber lands are scheduled to be harvested over the course of the 100-year rotation, which means that something on the order of 80 to 90% of the operable commercial timber, which translates probably into something in the neighborhood of 40% of the timber on the national forest lands, is scheduled for harvest at some point over that 100-year rotation. The available information based on research conducted by the Department of Fish and Game, the Forest Service, BC Fish and Wildlife Branch, University of British Columbia, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service indicates that once an old growth forest is converted into either a managed or unmanaged second growth stand, over and managed on a 100 or 150-year rotation, the productivity of that land will be drastically reduced for species, particularly black-tailed deer. So it would be a process that accumulated slower over the course over the public lands, assuming that the land management plan was not changed.
Let me just ask you another question. Two or three others, I think, that want to get into this.
I just want to ask you a question.
Oh, okay, go ahead. Can you pick up the question?
I know the Big Salt area, and I know the area on Prince of Wales Island pretty well, and the cutting there is going to have a large impact. And one of the reasons it's going to have a larger impact than it even should have is because the United States Forest Service and the Tongass National Forest and the United States government all allowed Admiralty Island to become certain protected area, but they didn't protect this area. They let those people come back down here, and many years ago, mm-hmm. the Tlingit and Haidas had that war fight already, and they once claimed this land and won it down here, the Haidas did, and the Tlingits were the northern people. Okay, now they allow them to come back down here and cut on Prince of Wales Island and on Long Island. They gave the land back to them after We fought for it once, not we, but our ancestors, and won it. And now again, they're allowing it to happen again, and our people have been outraged and angered over it, the elders especially, because they had been in their time. Some of them are still here.
Right.
And this happened, and now you come in and you say that there's going to be a mass impact down here. We knew that. But why didn't you protect us?
First of all,
see,
I mean, that wasn't my job, and I can assure you that the Wildlife Society, well, the Wildlife Society has been active in this issue for a long time. We have filed appeals against decisions made by the Forest Service. We provided input in the deliberation of both ANCSA and ANILCA. One of the concerns that we expressed with ANILCA was exactly the point that you're making, that by establishing the relatively large wilderness area on Admiralty Island, somebody had to trade off an awful lot of timber someplace down the line. And instead of allowing a certain amount of timber harvest on Admiralty Island and providing additional protection in other areas down here, that wasn't the way it went. The Wildlife Society has on record in various places as addressing those particular problems. And that, again, is one, the final point was one of the ones that I was trying to make here. We've got situations where corporations that are located on Admiralty Island or Haines, for example, because of the way the land selections were, the guidelines were laid out in ANCSA, wound up making selections on Long Island or Prince of Wales Island. And it really doesn't make any difference to somebody from Haines or Hoona if they annihilate the forest on Prince of Wales or Long Island, because they're never going to see it. But to the people that live here, it has some dramatic effects. And that's the main point that I want to make, is the problem with the way the legislation was set up, that there wasn't good linkage between the land managers and the corporations and a lot of the people that live on the lands that are dependent on it. And it may be that the village corporation there, is it Cabilco? Yeah, where you have a relatively small area and control of the land base within the village, you're able to optimize your land management or make that more compatible with the interests of the people that live there.
Are you saying that there's really no way of logging these areas without reducing the, let us say, the deer population?
There is probably no economically viable way of doing it. In Southeast Alaska, the timber market, particularly in recent years, has been so soft that basically the only way you can make money is to clear cut, particularly in the higher volume stands. The Forest Service on public land, the Tongass National Forest, is currently operating at a deficit of about 13-1 for every dollar of revenue returned to the United States government by selling the timber. They spend about $13 of taxpayer money in order to keep the industry going. Obviously, the corporations don't have that luxury of somebody giving them the money to build their roads, and that's one of the reasons why the utilization standards are different. The native corporations in many areas can't afford to remove the pulp logs, so they stay in the woods. The Forest Service forces the timber operators on those public lands to remove them, even if it costs them money, and then they somehow, money chases money around, so it all evens out. You could perhaps undertake some selective logging or some other types of timber harvest in Southeast other than clear-cut logging. Short of that, there really isn't any way that you won't have some effect on the carrying capacity, particularly for deer. So there are obviously some ways that are better than others. If you take a valley like Ward Creek Valley or the head of Big Salt Lagoon, where you've got 1,000 or 1,500 acres that's been cut over the period of 2 to 3 years. That area within 10 to 15 years, once the second growth forest, the very dense regeneration closes in on those areas, they're too thick to walk through. You can't hunt them. There's very little there to hunt anyway.
So you can have these massive drainage areas that are drastically affected. Whereas if you took smaller cuts over a period of time, you could spread the effects out somewhat.
Well, part of this is simply the problem of small corporations, small compared to Weyerhaeuser or Louisiana Pacific, engaging in logging activities. Mm-hmm. Any small operator, native or non-native, would be forced to do it in the same way, even assuming everything you've said.
Right. Yeah, I don't see any other viable approach, and that was why I said if in fact the objective of providing a land base was to provide for the subsistence uses, if that was the primary motivation, then to turn those lands over to corporations which are responsible for making money for their shareholders, that is going to conflict simply because of the biology of the species and the forest. There's going to be a conflict in Southeast Alaska.
Any
you're a native landholder, if you're any landholder,
certainly,
such as the Napanee area that was cut out. If you go and look up there, the deer population on that part of the island was the thickest. That's where the deer were, and also the goats and that lived in that area. And that was all cut out, and then they moved into the Coffman Cove area, and that was all cut out. And now the deer, finally, in many years of living in Tassan myself, last year was the first time we had deer roaming through the village. And right now at this time, you go through that and you talk to the people and hunters, that's where you find out things. You don't get it from a Forest Service man sitting at a desk or a corporation man sitting at a desk or anywhere. It's the man that goes out and hunts the woods that comes back with these stories. And if you listen, you can pretty well know where that is. And most native corporations are people. It's not a corporation, it's people. They stop and think, well, our deer are out there, let's set that aside and save it for them. And they're doing this. It's not something that you're going out there with native people and just cutting a tree down because it's a big cedar tree. They don't do that anymore. I mean, it's money, yes, but there's a lot of trees sitting out there that we can't even cut. Mm-hmm. And another thing, I don't know if you've looked lately, but out there on Prince of Wales Island, there's something harming our trees. It's bad.
Well, I don't work for the Forest Service, so.
It's getting to be a real bad problem.
Mr. Thomas,
Right. Sure. Yeah, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Smith. I think we've logged that particular area over now.
For the record, my name is Edward Thomas. I'm chairman of the board for Shawn's Heath, and my testimony will be relative to my relationship with that corporation. It's very interesting to listen to Mr. Smith's testimony, because prior to the Alaska Native Claims Act, those of us that lived on Prince of Wales Island were very much concerned about the vast amounts of timber that were being harvested at our back door. And we had, at that time, representatives from the federal as well as the state fish and game come over and tell us that such harvests are good for the deer because they have more room to roam openly without the trees getting in their way. And now that natives have land, it's just the reverse. We have those kinds of attitudes, so to speak, in the regulating agencies. We see that in log dumps in the Craig area where I'm from. We watch the A-frame loggers log one area and then move over another 100 yards and then set up another harvest pattern, dumping the trees into the water. We objected to those things. The Forest Service people come in and said, well, that's the only way they can do it. That's good. It's good for your economy. Now that natives have land in the entire area of the west coast of Prince of Wales, where Craig Kloak and the Sea Alaska holdings all the way around Big Salt Lake, we are only allowed one dump. You can't dump even your limbs overboard. Otherwise, you have to file an environmental impact statement. the regulations that we are experiencing are tremendous in expense as well as impact and attitude. The resentment of many of us that are involved in trying to muddle through this Alaska Native Claims Act for the purpose of what it's intended is really difficult. It's getting more and more expensive. You can't anymore go out and say, well, this is my road plan. I want a road here so I can log these trees off. You got to go have an engineer study and got to be approved by some other permitting agency. And those are normal. We accept them. But when it gets down to other types of regulations, now I understand that in the case pending with the city of Angoon versus Marsh, I believe is the name, it's recommended that all of these developments are now going to be required to submit a documented environmental impact statement to do any development. And these things are expensive. I'm sure Louis, doing the study they did, we did one in Chauncey, to study the impacts on the land and to try to develop in a way that is conducive to the environment as well as our own land management plans. And they cost a lot of money. I, for one, have not the experience of having going to environmental schools and the things that the colleges that you talked about studying deer. But I've been there over 40 years in the Craig area and have studied the impacts of people on deer. When I was a youngster in Craig, we used to be able to go get deer right off the mountain right behind us. Now there are so many people coming from Ketchikan all the way from south, coming in camper trailers on the ferry, that you can't even find a place to hunt anymore in a given week in the beginning of the season in the fall. Comparatively speaking, the native holdings on Prince of Wales Island, it's quite small compared to the Louisiana Pacific harvest. If you look at the Harris River drainage, which was completely logged off, you look at the whole Hollis harvest pattern, how much timber they took out of there, and you look at the Thorn Bay operation, the Whale Pass, and Kaufman Cove, and now over in, you'll see it up in El Capitan, there's a big logging operation. All those are wiping out thousands of acres of timber. The Forest Service new plan now is to clear cut all the islands from Cape Lynch and Coronation Island all the way down to Cape Nizan against the objections of the local fishermen, the local people, the majority of which are natives, that rely upon the continuation of that habitat for fisheries and wildlife and trapping that was spoke of. Who cares? And the Forest Service decided to do that. You can contest as if you're an individual till you're blue in the face. They made up their mind. They got a big camp out there right now studying how they're going to cut them down, the quickest way to get rid of it. But one little township that is given to the natives is under so much scrutiny, we're going to have so many permits. We don't have the Forest Service come in and studying and say, this is the best way to do it. You say, it's your land, study it, do it yourself. Pay the money. But all these large corporations, Louisiana Pacific, Alaska Timber, and Pulp, the Forest Service does all their studying for them. The road building, the impacts, all those things are done before they walk in, they cut the trees off, some of the jobs, and that's it. Us, we got to do everything ourselves, and that's just really, it's really contrary to the intent. That's what I'm trying to say. The original in discussions that I listened to in the early land claims settlement negotiations were very similar to what happened down in the lower 48 in the fisheries harvest. The plan was to have, instead of granting people lands to harvest off, they would keep those lands for their own utilization, whether it be subsistence or otherwise, and then there would be a tax or windfall profit tax on other resources so that we wouldn't have to keep harvesting. And we harvest timber the way it is, the profits come off there or whatever comes off, and the percentages go to the natives. That's the way it should be. We should, if they do good in fishing, everybody gets fish, give profits to the natives. They own part of it. I think that would be a lot simpler way to do it. We'd keep our lands and tax those other resources that are being harvested. The difficulty in dealing with permits is a learning process, but I think it's they're overzealous in dealing with native holdings. I think that's something we really got to look at. I'm going to wander into another area because I think we've pretty much exhausted this area. The issue of 7I and dealing with sand and gravel, I think is a very, sand, gravel, and rock, is a very touchy issue with regional corporations, and I think it's one that is overutilized. They interpreted the law too greatly in the favor of 7I for the purposes of utilizing subsurface resources. The rock, sand, and gravel that are utilized by the village corporations to build roads is really not leaving the land, therefore is really not a subsurface resource, as would be gold, as would be oil, as would be something else that is removed from the land. So I really think that sand, gravel, and rock should be excluded from these provisions of 7I and should be left at the discretion of the regional corporations to work out with the village corporations. It's a very costly process for village corporations to build roads anyway, and to have to pay the fair market value of rock, which prior to the village corporations doing anything, there was no value to it at all. So if you took that as the basis, then the value is not one that is saleable to anybody else, because nobody else would be able to use that rock anyway. It would just be the village corporation. I think the ability of village corporations to work in the area of timber harvest is becoming less and less. And I think the more we're regulated, the more we're going to have to harvest to break even. If it's going to cost us 90% of the value of the logs to market, you know, in order to meet your needs, you're going to have to harvest more timber. And I think people are going to start recognizing that all these regulations is not going to stop the utilization of the resource. It's just going to put more money in the pocket of somebody else instead of the people that it's intended to. And I think that it's very hard for me to totally agree with the blanket utilizations of terms. For example, native private lands means one thing to Gavilco, and it means something else to Shaanxi. I think I would like to compare some of the harvests that we had in Shaanxi land with that was harvested in the Harris River drainage by the Forest Service. The amount of stumpage and logs and debris left behind in those compared to Shaanxi is noticeable. They have much more left behind. Of course, that's not all of Shaanxi either. Some of Shaanxi, we left some of the pulpwood that was mentioned by Mr. Smith. We had to leave some behind, but then we decided if we're going to be harvesting, we're going to at least stack those so that our new growth would come in and be able to grow in an environment that trees normally grow in. But I think it's important to try to understand the pressures that are put on the native corporations, the kind of a glass house we live in. I think everybody is waiting for mistakes to be made by the corporation so that someone else can make another regulation. And I think it's too bad. I think that we should be regulating some of those other folks a long time ago instead of worrying about it now. And I think generally that's the feeling of many of our people in our corporation. I can't speak on behalf of everyone, but I know the discussions in our board meetings have recognized the vast amount of regulations that are imposed upon us compared to people that logged there not even 10 years ago. and it's really frightening to see the differences. That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Does anyone else wish to speak at this time? I think that what we might do is take a coffee break for 5 or 10 minutes, and then when you've collected your thoughts, we'll resume and in a few minutes and carry on. And order again to see if anybody would like to say anything further at this time. I'm going to be here most of the afternoon, so I'm at your disposal. And if anybody would like to speak now, that's fine. And if not, we'll continue with our coffee break. But
my name is Estelle Thompson, used to be Durgan. I'm going to talk today as a director of Cavilco Incorporated. Last night I sent a message here from acting as the mayor of the second-class city of Kassan, which made a little different statement. What I'd like to say today, although it is apparent to everyone that Cavilco Incorporated is a successful small corporation, we are, at this time, a successful small corporation, but that doesn't mean that ANSCA has worked well for every corporation. I look around me and see a lot of poverty yet amongst the Native people, and at one time when ANSCA first came into effect, there were big headlines in the paper that within a 5-year period there will not be another Native in Alaska on the welfare list. There still are many Alaskans on the welfare list, Native people. And the elders are still in hard times. Most of the elders are still being buried by the state or by a Social Security bond or some other way. They're not being buried with their own money, and they're not being taken care of properly. We find this all the time. I have a mother right now who is penniless and living in the Ketchikan General Hospital. She is in the elderly care unit. She doesn't receive any money from ANSCA or any way of taking care of her. This to me is very sad because many of the people are dying in this state with this in the thought. You hear them speak out and there's tears in their voices because they expected a lot from their land settlement. Either the land should have been theirs, given to them rightfully in a package like maybe 160 acres, 200 acres or whatever to each individual rather than a large land settlement made amongst a group of people and taken care of that way. I don't have any answers for anything, but I feel that maybe in stretching things out and putting it down and listening to everyone's talk of how this should have been or how it could have been and what it could have amounted to, I do think that ANSCA in its present situation is a failure to most Alaska Natives. Not to all, but to most of them it is. And that's really all I have to say on it.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
I'd just like to make a few comments in general. I'm Louis Thompson again. On the act, I felt that not enough time was spent during the enrollment process, and I think if anybody done a survey, they'd find that there was brother and sister that was enrolled in various other places. They weren't enrolled together from the village that they might have represented. There was a lot of them that was left out because there was a big misunderstanding. A few of the things that come to mind was like under the terms of the act, if you were adopted by two full-blooded Native parents, you automatically accepted their blood quantum. And people didn't really understand that the enumerators weren't very well informed, and a lot of mistakes was made in that area. I think, you know, there was other injustices, I'm sure, that we talk of the 1991 issues, we talk of the newborn that were born after 1971. I really don't have an answer for that. My only answer would be that the land that was given up to the under the Plinkett and Haida Judgment Fund, I think that there's an obligation there to take care of them people socially, or the younger ones socially, or educationally. I think there's organizations that are right there already formed that could handle some of those situations. I think that, you know, living in a, well, maybe I should tell this story. Living in a small community, it, you know, people have a tendency to go back in time, or maybe it's a visionary type effect, but that is funneled through loved ones. They appear to certain individuals, maybe through a vision, and the vision is repeated to others, and so the story goes that they're telling the intent of our ancestors as to the Land Claim Settlement Act and probably how we should proceed. So what they say is we're doing nothing different than they did in the old days, but we're following an organizational structure that is age old, that is part of our culture and heritage, where we could resemble like house tribes or our house chiefs and house or family members within a house, and then we could represent the village chief and the representatives of each house chief under a council concept. And I think that we have the structures, and if we just look back in history as to the formation and the governing actions of the Native people, I think that we could again repeat history based under that structure. And I think that there's a big point that's really being missed, because the region of Alaska is so large that we almost have to look at it within as regions, as it's broken out in the Act. And if they start there as a basis, at least to the region, then break it down further to the village, and have equal representation and make a proper selection, because if they look back in time, they had an apprenticeship program, so to speak. Not everybody became carvers, not everybody became speakers or representatives of the tribe, and I think if you associate that with the existing structures we have today, I think we within the group, the Native people, they have the talent that's available. It's a matter of picking them out and putting them in their proper niches. I think that, you know, the history is really repeating itself, and we have to take the opportunity to really take a hard look at it, because maybe I repeat myself, but I think there's a talent that could fit and take care of the health needs of the Native people, the political needs, and the management needs, and it's no different than it was in the past without documented organizations. I think that in this day and age that there's a lot of Native people that have the qualifications through proper education that could fulfill these needs and develop a proper organizational structure that would be successful throughout the state of Alaska. And I think it could start with the village corporations working jointly with the IRA councils or Clinkett and Haida local chapters. There's functions that could be performed by these organizations that could band together to fulfill the intent of the Act. I think the Act is just something that just forms another organization that has a way of developing an economic base that would supplement some of the other funding agencies that might go through the IRA councils or Tlingit Haida Central Council. And I think that when we're looking throughout and testifying at this commission hearing, that I think the realization should be made that our needs in southeastern region are not, probably not the same, and I'm sure that it's been well spoken of, that there are very much difference between the needs of the interior people. Their land base isn't comparable to ours. They don't have the timber resources. I think, in essence, they were robbed to a certain extent because they do not own the subsurface rights. I think there was a mistake made there that the subsurface rights should have gone to the surface estate owner. And I think that, you know, the regional corporation could have managed the, they could have eliminated the Section 7I section of the Act. That would have gave them a lot larger latitude. Of course, then there would have been a little more fear of the 1991 issues, because then it could have been a reality of somebody taking that over. I might, maybe I'm just rambling, but I think that we hear talk of turning the land over in trust. I have a total commitment towards a disagreement to that respect, because I think that we as the profit-making corporation elected a 9-member board that is really the trustees of that land, with the capability of devising methods or a plan of action that would eliminate either take over or release the land. I don't believe that there's an intent of any of the corporations, village or regional, that are devising or seeking a plan to either sell or give the land away. Speaking of selling or giving the land away, we devised a method, and we're given the opportunity through an ILCA, the amendment under the 14C municipal reconveyance. We still had the clout as a Native community to have the second class municipality waiver the right under 14C. In turn, we are working on it was spoken of yesterday, working on a sort of a land lottery to the shareholders of Kvilco of an acre and a half that could be awarded without any tax consequence, which will, it'll amount to probably a little better than a 200-acre development site adjacent to the existing community. And we felt that that obligation to the municipal conveyance was fulfilled by doing this. And that still gave our people the control over the land. We feel that that is one way of accomplishing a survey that we'd conducted previously to find out what our shareholders really would like out of the Act. We found that they would like some type of dividend program and a piece of land that they could call their own, even though that the majority of their land was managed by a board of directors. And we've
under ANILCA you can transfer an acre and a half is it to shareholders?
We could transfer an acre and a half to each individual shareholders without a tax consequence. There's only one provision, and it's kind of a loose interpretation, is that the individual receiving it cannot subdivide it for a period of 10 years after receipt. But it doesn't say anything about if the individual wants to sell the acre and a half in total without subdivision. It doesn't mention that in the amendment.
And I think Mrs. Thompson said last night the plan is to convey an acre and a half to all shareholders, whether they're living at Kasan or not.
Yes, that's correct.
This, you, the corporation regards this as fulfillment of its obligations under the section of ANILCA relating to municipal reconveyance?
Well, that is our interpretation. Otherwise, if we would, it would fulfill that obligation under 14C, the municipal reconveyance. And that is our interpretation, because had we gone along before the amendment to award 1,280 acres to a second-class municipality, it would come under Alaska statutes, and there's only a couple ways that, or three ways that could land could be distributed to individuals under Alaska statutes. And it doesn't necessarily mean you could be discriminatory with the distribution of that land. And it was a godsend that somebody had the foresight to amend the act and allow less than 1,280 acres to be conveyed under that program. We've inherited other problems with lands under 14G, which was administrative transfer of Forest Service residential or special residential use permits. And they've been nothing but costly and a headache because the court system won't allow us to enforce any of the provisions of the residential use permit as was enforced by the United States Forest Service. They said we could be no more stringent to enforcement than the Forest Service was under their administration. I think another thing that we're seeing history repeat itself is I think, you know, the act was a negotiated settlement without really the knowledge of the people that were being involved in it. Like in the Southeast region, we have 15,800 shareholders in the Sea Alaska region. Very few of them, if any, understand what the settlement was about or how it was negotiated. I think very few of them understand the basic contents or have ever read a copy of the act in total. It's there's so many stories that floats around as to what the intent of the act really was. I probably wore out several copies, and I still really don't understand it. I know that I've been involved in numerous court hearings in sections of the act that there isn't a judge in the state of Alaska that would render an opinion or ruling on any one of the areas of the act. It would have to go back to a federal court for a determination. It's been a field day for attorneys and consultants. I feel that they've been using fear tactics and say that if we don't do this or don't do that, we're interpreting something wrong, so we need attorney legal advice or accounting advice or consulting advice. And it's a pure tactic, and I think that I kind of got off base. I was starting to mention the fact that we lost track of what our people really wanted in terms of the contents of the act, and I think that we ended up seeking